the asteroid belt and beyond. I'm putting the pieces together right now. I'm going to be the wealthiest man in the solar system, richer than you and all your brothers put together. Maybe then you'll treat me with some respect. Before his father could reply, Humphrey sat up in his recliner and pressed the stud set into the armrest to terminate the videophone link. The old man's face disappeared from the wall, revealing a hollow window that showed a real-time view of Jupiter as seen by the 20-meter telescope at the Far Side Observatory. For a long moment, Humphrey simply sat there, alone in the office he had set up for himself in the house deep below the lunar surface. Then he took a long, slow breath to calm the furies that raged inside him. The old man has no understanding of the real world. He's still living in the past. He'd rather go down with the ship than admit that I'm right and he's wrong. Unbidden, the memory of his drowning engulfed him again. 9 years old. His father insisting that the trimaran was in no trouble despite the dark storm winds that heaved the boat so monstrously. The wave that washed him overboard. The frothing water closing over him, desperately clawing for the surface but sinking, sinking. Can't breathe. Everything going dark. Martin Humphreys died at the age of 9. After they revived him, he learned that it had been one of the crew who dived into the Sound to rescue him. Watching the boy sink out of sight, his father had stayed aboard the trimaran and offered a bonus to any crewman who could rescue his son. From that moment on, Humphreys knew that there was no one in the world he could trust. He was alone with only his inner fears and yearnings to drive him, and only his money to protect him. Talking with his father always brought those terrible moments back to mind, and the gasping, choking paralysis that clamped his chest like a merciless vice. He reached into the top desk drawer for his inhalator and took a desperate whiff of the cool, soothing drug. All right, Humphreys thought, waiting for his breathing to return to normal, trying to calm himself. He's going to stay down there and try to fight the new morality until they burn him at the stake. Nothing I say will budge him a millimeter. Very well, then. I'll stay here in Selene where it's safe and everything's under control. No storms, no rain, a world built to suit me in every detail. From here, I can pull the strings just as effectively as if I were down in New York or London. Better, really. There's no reason for me to go Earthside anymore. Except for the divorce hearing, he remembered. I'm supposed to show up in the judge's chambers for that. But I can do even that from here. Get my lawyers to make the excuse that I can't return to Earth. I've been on the moon too long. It would be dangerous to my health. I can get a dozen doctors to testify to that. No sweat. Humphreys laughed aloud. I won't have to be in the same room with that bitch. Good. Wonderful. He leaned back again and stared up at the ceiling. It was set to a planetarium display, the sky as it appeared above Selene. Briefly, he thought about calling up a porno video, but decided instead to put on the latest informational release from the International Astronautical Authority about the microprobes searching through the asteroids in the belt. The IAA's motivation for investigating the asteroids was to locate rocks that might one day hit the Earth. They had good tracks on all the hundreds of asteroids in orbits that brought them close to Earth. Now they were sorting through the thousands of rocks out in the belt big enough to cause serious damage if they were ejected from the belt and impacted Earth. The good news was that so far they had not found any asteroid in an orbit that threatened the homeworld, although the asteroids in the belt were always being jostled by Jupiter and the other planets, their orbits perturbed unpredictably. A constant watch was a vital necessity. The better news was that, as a byproduct of the impactor watch, the IAA was getting detailed data on the composition of the larger asteroids. Iron, carbon, nickel, phosphorus, nitrogen, gold, silver, platinum, even water was out there in vast abundance, ripe for picking. Waiting for me to turn them into money, Humphreys told himself, smiling happily. Dan Randolph will send a team out to the belt on a fusion rocket. The first mission will fail, of course, and then I'll have Randolph where I want him. I'll take control of Astro Corporation and we can put Randolph out to pasture, where he belongs. Then a thought clouded his satisfaction. It's been damn near 6 months since I hired Pancho Lane to keep an eye on Randolph. Why haven't I heard from her?
La Guaira.
Aren't you nervous? Amanda Cunningham asked. Sitting beside her as the clipper ship returned to Earth, Poncho shook her head. Nope. You?
A bit.
Uh-huh.
I mean, meeting the head of the corporation. It's rather exciting, don't you think?
Poncho and Amanda had been summoned to Astro Manufacturing's corporate headquarters in La Guaira, on an island across the strait from Caracas. Something about a new assignment that Dan Randolph himself would decide.
Well, meeting the big boss is important, I guess,
Poncho said as nonchalantly as she could manage. They were riding the clipper ship down from the aging space station, Nueva Venezuela, to the landing field at La Guaira, riding comfortably in the nearly empty passenger cabin, with a sparse handful of paying customers, rather than in the cramped cockpit where the crew worked. Amanda reveled in the luxury of spacious seats and entertainment videos. Poncho figured that something important was waiting for them when they landed, something important enough for Astro to undergo the expense of letting them ride deadhead from Cellini.
Well, she said to herself, the pilots up in the cockpit are really deadheading too.
Clipper ships flew under control from the ground. They didn't need an onboard crew any more than a ballistic missile did. But even after all these years, decades really, the politicians refused to allow spacecraft that carried passengers to fly fully automated. The pilots had to go along. There had to be a cockpit and full controls for them, even though they had absolutely nothing to do.
Don't complain, she said to herself. If the aerospace lines didn't need to hire pilots, you wouldn't have gotten a job in the first place. You'd still be sitting in front of the display screen in some cubicle back in Lubbock doing tech support and barely making enough money to keep Sis alive.
Amanda was flicking through the entertainment channels, eyes locked on her little pop-up screen. Poncho eased back in the comfortable passenger's chair and closed her eyes.
Why me? She asked herself. Why has the CEO of Astro Manufacturing called me all the way back from Cellini to see him in person?
Amanda, I can understand. One look at her ID vid and the big boss probably started panting like a dog in heat.
Still, Poncho had to admit that Mandy was a damn good pilot, boobs notwithstanding. In the 6 months since they'd first met, Poncho had acquired a healthy respect for Amanda's piloting skills.
This is her first job and she's already as good as I am. Well, almost. I'm the best pilot Astro's got, flat out.
But what's that got to do with seeing the CEO? Why does he want to see me?
Does Humphreys have anything to do with this?
He wants me to spy on Astro, which means he probably wants me to spy on Randolph himself. So maybe he's worked things out so's I get to see Randolph face to face. Is Humphreys pulling the strings inside Randolph's own company?
It never occurred to Poncho that Dan Randolph wanted to see her for reasons of his own. The clipper ship rode smoothly through re-entry, with only a few moments of turbulence as it plunged into the Earth's atmosphere like a squat, cone-shaped meteor, plummeting so fast that the very air outside the craft heated to incandescence.
We're a fallen star, Poncho told herself, as she sat tightly buckled into her seat while the ship shuddered and jounced.
She could hear the muted howl of the tortured air on the other side of the hull, mere centimeters from her seat.
A falling star. Some kid down there is probably making a wish on our trail.
The shaking and banshee wail of re-entry ended swiftly, and the flight smoothed out.
We'll be landing in 4 minutes, the captain's rich baritone voice announced over the intercom. Don't be alarmed by all the banging and roaring. It's just the retro rockets and the landing struts deploying.
Poncho smiled.
That's what we need the crew for, reassuring announcements.
It felt as if they were falling until the retros fired briefly, pushing Poncho deep into her seat. Another drop, so short she barely had time to feel it, before the retros roared out a longer blast. Then everything went silent and still.
We're on the ground, the captain said, sounding relieved.
Poncho had expected that she and Amanda would be sent directly to Randolph's office for their interview with the CEO, or at least to the personnel department for a briefing on what they should expect. Instead, once they'd cleared the access tunnel, they were met in the terminal by a good-looking young Latino in a business suit who led them out to the garage and a sleek-looking sedan.
Your luggage is being picked up.